Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 139. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at a couple of Australian detective movies from the 70s and the 80s. I'm going to start off with Jack Thompson's starring film based on John Cleary's novel Helga's Web, and that is 1975's Scobie Malone. I'm then going 10 years forward to look at the only adaptation of a Peter Corris novel, and that is The Empty Beach, starring Brian Brown, from 1985. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. Hi, how is everybody doing? We're doing kind of fine here, apart from the fact that I have a head cold at the moment. So if my tones are not as dulcet as usual, that's the reason why. It is still winter here, very cold morning this morning by our lights, and but apart from that, things ain't too bad. The Patreon campaign is going very well. We've got a few more subscribers, which means that pretty much the hosting for the podcast is covered, which is terrific. I always wanted to make this a revenue neutral thing, and I've finally found a way to do it, and I do like that, and I do appreciate very much the fact that people are willing to put a couple of dollars in to help me with that. I did make a mistake with the Patreon campaign. Nothing that impacts subscribers at all, but I didn't put all of my PayPal details in. I put them in once, but apparently you've got to put them in twice for some reason. And so I won't be getting the money till the beginning of August, at which stage I'll be looking at getting the software so I can start transcribing the podcasts into text and finding a way to get them out and about to people who are interested in having them. And then anything above that, which there isn't money above that, goes towards the hosting. And all of that was laid out on the Patreon page, so it's not like I'm springing any surprises on people. But, you know, well, things going along here, the solstice has happened, so the weather is starting to turn warmer here. Yes, we still have a Conservative government in Australia, which is a burden to everybody, most particularly refugees who are trying to get into Australia, but I'll let you look that up yourself if you're not aware of what's happening with that. And, yeah, we're starting to get into the summer movie season from the Northern Hemisphere, so I'm looking forward to things like Guardians of the Galaxy coming out and all those kind of geeky action films where I get my 3D glasses on and get my popcorn and my drink and just sit back and turn into a total fanboy for a couple of months. So that's about to happen. So I'm going to take a look now at what I have been watching as far as non-genre media is concerned. I'm still doing the radio gig, so Liz Travaskis and I reviewed a couple of movies. We did The Adventures of Barry McKenzie because I was asked to do an Australian comedy, so we did that one starring Barry Humphries and Barry Crocker. That was a bit of fun to revisit. And then just this last week we did The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. We decided, someone gave us, we've got this thing at the moment where the listeners on the radio give me a genre. And so they gave me spaghetti westerns, and I went with The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. And so Liz and I talked about that and had a great time grokking on that one and just grooving to it, and really both of us enjoyed it a lot. I hadn't seen it for a very long time, and revisiting it again was a lot of fun for me, so I had a bit of a time with that. There isn't really too much else that I've watched as far as non-genre movies is concerned, but I have been watching a bit of television on my Chromecast now that I can stream YouTube and other video streaming sites directly onto the big TV. I've been really getting into that, and I found out you can get a lot of episodes of one of my favorite old-time Western TV series on YouTube, and that's Have Gun, Will Travel, starring Richard Boone. So I've been dipping into a few of those. You can get episodes of Mannix, the old TV detective show starring Mike Connors. And the other one I've been dipping into just a little bit, it's kind of genre stuff, but I can eat these like popcorn, and that's episodes of the animated series Batman the Brave and the Bold, where basically Batman teams up with a different DC superhero every time. and they've been getting some really good ones. There's about three seasons of that, so while I'm doing my exercise on the torturous exercise machine, I can watch an episode or two of Batman Brave and Bold and feel virtuous while doing it. But apart from that, not too much else, just episodic TV and all my usual political shows and other things like that. It's been a little quiet, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. I must be hibernating a little bit, but things will pick up. Let me see how many movies I've watched so far this year, and I have been keeping track. 243. Now, I know there are people that have seen a lot more than 243, but I don't think that's a particularly bad score for me to have done. The other thing I've got going at the moment, and this one I find very arduous and torturous and enervating and disgusting, is on the Patreon campaign, I had this brain fart where I put it out there that if a certain amount of money was donated, I would, for the next Martian Drive-In podcast, review all three Star Wars movies. Now, everybody knows how much I don't like Star Wars movies. So what happened was, my friend Jane threw the money in. One person, a friend of mine, wanted to fuck me up. She did, and she threw the money in for me to review all three Star Wars movies. And I've started watching the first one, Star Wars, and I'm not going to say too much about it apart from the fact that tonally it is really, really bad. And I've got a feeling by the time I reach the third film, and yes, everybody knows the second and the third films are better, but by the time I reach the third film, I've got a feeling I'm going to have a higher annoyance level. But I'm going to give it a good honest go. I'm going to just let it be what it is. I'm going to bring my perceptions of movies towards it, try to put aside preconceptions as much as possible with this kind of movie, and review them. But I'm about a third of the way through the first one. I was starting to fall asleep, and it's not looking good for a positive review. I'll be honest with you about that. It really is not looking good at all for that. Nonetheless, I've got the commitment. I'm going to do it. I'm going to get it out of the way as quick as I can. As Sherlock Holmes once said, the swiftest surgery is the least painful. And the next Martian Drive-In podcast, I'm going to review the three Star Wars movies. And I've got a whole bunch of friends who are Star Wars fans who are looking forward to me doing that. I don't know whether they have an innate masochism or whether they just want to have a bit of fun. But one way or the other, next one is the big Star Wars special, and I'm going to do that. And I don't yet know what's going to happen, but something will. Okay, so let's talk about 1970s Australian cinema for a moment. The Australian Film Development Corporation had a lot of funding to give people for making movies, which was great. It's the whole reason we have Ausploitation and that kind of renaissance of Australian filmmaking at the time. This film was made in 1975, so it was made right at the end of the Whitlam government, just before the Governor General basically cancelled Parliament, and there was a what they call the dismissal, and a subsequent election of the Fraser ministry and a Conservative government, which started making the changes, which have now gone on to making Australia a much less nice place than it used to be. But 1975, we were cocky, we were arrogant, we were making films that we liked because we wanted to make them, and people like Jack Thompson were starting to have really good careers. Jack Thompson had become famous for a couple of decent films, the first one being Peterson, which is known in some quarters as Jock Peterson, and the second one was Sunday Too Far Away, which is about the shearers' strike in the 1950s and about sheep shearing out in the outback. Both really good Australian films, and at some stage I'd like to look at them in paleo cinema and just discuss that period of time. In a genuine way, it was a golden age of Australian cinema. The funding was there. People could make different kinds of movies. Some succeeded, some failed. Some were stepping stones for people who went on to make better works. There were jobs for actors and technicians and directors and writers. And all those people involved in the film industry really did get a boost at that stage. Now, a few years before, in about 1968, a movie was made in England based on a novel by John Cleary called The High Commissioner. It's also known in some quarters as Nobody Runs Forever. It was a movie starring Rod Taylor as New South Wales police detective Scobie Malone And it also had Christopher Plummer in it, Dahlia Lavi, and a few other people. It was an English film. It didn't make a lot of money, but it was the first adaptation of John Cleary's Escape from Malone novels. There ended up being about 10 or 12 of them. And in 1970, Cleary wrote the second novel based on the character of Scobie Malone, this New South Wales police detective. And that was called Helga's Web. And it's about the body of a high-class prostitute being found in the basement of the Sydney Opera House and the investigation that went along with that and investigating her relationships, her connections, and her client list went right up through the hierarchy of Sydney political identities and also criminal identities. So, now, Scobie Malone in the novels and to a certain extent in the Rod Taylor movie was a dead upright guy. He was a good Catholic Irish Australian. He ended up marrying Lisa, the woman he met in the novel The High Commissioner, a Dutch diplomat, and they settled in Sydney and had built a life there with a family. Now, that isn't the story that we get from the 1975 movie Scobie Malone, starring Jack Thompson. The character is very, very different from the one that Rod Taylor played. Now, this movie has a tonal shift between the two parts of the film. There's Scobie in his personal life, which is one way. Then there's the murder that he's investigating, which is tonally very, very different from that. Now, I'll read you out the Wikipedia précis for the film. Sydney homicide detective Scobie Malone, Jack Thompson, and his offsider Russ Clements, Shane Porteous, investigate the murder of Helga, whose corpse is found in the basement of the Sydney Opera House. She's played by Judy Morris, by the way. Malone has met Helga previously and discovers that she was a high-class prostitute who was also the mistress of the Minister for Culture, played by James Condon, and involved with the film director Jack Savannah, played by Joe Martin. In flashback, it's shown that Helga was blackmailing the minister and his wife, Jekyll and Knott, along with a crime boss, Mr. Sin, played by Noel Ferrier. So that's pretty much it. She was out for money. She was totally greedy and self-focused and was not only trying to blackmail a minister for the state government, but she was also trying to blackmail a very large crime lord. Now, the supporting cast of this has a lot in common with the supporting cast of the second film we're going to talk about, The Empty Beach, in that a lot of the people involved are more well-known for television than they are for cinema. And that, of course, is a necessity at this stage. And I keep bumping that microphone. It's a necessity at this stage because with film production only just having started in Australia in a big way after that hiatus in the 50s, 60s and very, very early 1970s, a lot of the experienced people had worked in television. Now, you've got Judy Morris, a very fine actor. She's really good as Helga in this film. Shane Porteous, who went along to do a lot of TV work in TV shows like A Country Practice. Noel Ferrier, a stage and cinema actor. You might remember him from a movie that starred Susanna York called Eliza Fraser. He played her husband in that film. Kind of portly, rotund guy. Jacqueline Knott is very good as the minister's wife, Norma Halladin. James Condon as Walter Halladin. He did a lot of television as well. There's a guy called Joe Martin who plays Jack Savannah. I'll just play a little bit of interaction between Jack and Helga, and then I'll explain why Joe Martin is such an interesting character.
Well, and what gets you out of a soft bed this time of morning?
An ache to see you, lover. And I need some money.
Just a pigeon to pluck. Up to my arse in bills, unprocessed films. I don't know who hates me more. Bank manager or the film authorities?
Oh, just a little money to keep Helga's teeth smiling. I owe the dentist 60 and he won't even look at my darling little bicuspid until I pay up. Actually, I could try to work off the debt with him. Not a very sexy man, though.
I think we can save you from the wrong end of the drill. 60 isn't a ripple on my side of debt.
I've done a bit of research on Joe Martin beyond which is required for the podcast, mostly because I was following trails and learning things. Joe Martin he had a talk show for a brief time on Australian television in the early 1970s. And before that, he was the MC and compere at a very famous nightclub in Sydney called Checkers from about the mid-1950s well into the 1960s. And so he met all sorts of celebrities who came and played at Checkers. It was like one of the top venues in town at the time. And the other thing I know about Checkers nightclub, which was really fascinating, was every Friday night there was a raffle. A very beautiful woman would come around and sell raffle tickets to the people in the audience for £5 a throw per ticket. And most people knew what the raffle was for, and those that didn't asked. And the raffle was, if you won the raffle, you got to take her home for the night. And this girl would do that once a week and make her money, make her living by raffling herself off once a week to the patrons of the Checkers nightclub. This folds into the movie nicely because Jo Martin, having lived in a nightclub kind of lifestyle, his character Jack Savannah visits illegal gambling establishments, talks to Mr. Sin, played by Noel Ferrier, and basically he was very familiar with the environment. He wasn't known as an actor, he was known more as a variety artist, but I think he's very good as Jack Savannah in this film, and he gives it a lot of verisimilitude. And of the supporting player, he's one of the two or three that I really like in this film. The other one is Jacqueline Knopp playing Norma Heldon, the wife of the cabinet minister, Lady Macbeth in a sense. And she is very good as well, and puts across a very strong portrayal as the strong, connected woman supporting a weak and not very bright husband to follow his political career and, of course, keep their status in society. There's some really nice dialogue by her that I'll play now, which goes to show some of the strengths of this movie as a drama.
Minister Walter P. Hillam on the steps of Parliament. Sportsman Walter Hillam on his yacht. Here's a daisy. The Minister for Cultural Development and Society Leader wife Norma at the cocktail party which celebrated her election to chairwoman of the Red and White Board.
Well, girls, that's it for the subcommittees, except for the selection of someone to handle the seating. Beastie task. Whoever gets it's certain to reap a crop of enemies. I wouldn't dream of sticking one of you. But it simply comes down to whom I dislike that much. Louise County. Dare I? Yes. Yes, of course. This will absolutely make my day. Oh, don't get me wrong, girls. We've been the dearest of friends ever since we were schoolmates, despite the fact that she absolutely spat chips when she wasn't elected as chairwoman. What a dear girl she is. I remember once... No, I better not tell you.
Oh, that's silly, girls.
Please, please, don't tell anyone.
Oh, no word. Good heavens, no.
She couldn't have been more than 16 at the time when she ruined an entire school rugby team right on the eve of a great public school final. Hello, Charles. How are you? It's Norma Hellerton here. Could I speak to Louise? The next day she cheered the other side on to victory and that night accommodated that whole lot. Oh, but she's so respectable now. She's even played hostess to Billy Graham.
Oh.
Hello, Louise, darling. I'm so thrilled. A stunning news for you.
There you go. That's what Norma Heldon's like. And there are some great scenes in this film. If you take it apart from Scobie's personal life, it's not a bad little thriller. It's a murder mystery. It talks a little bit to a subject that I'm really interested in, which is Sydney crime in the 20th century. My interest is a couple of things. Firstly, it's a really interesting time when there was police corruption, there was political corruption. The Premier of New South Wales actually blocked an entire street so that casino tables could be lifted in by crane for an illegal casino in King's Cross back in the 1960s. That was back when Sir Robin Askin was Premier and he was as corrupt as hell. And this kind of collusion between crime, police and politics in New South Wales is the reason why New South Wales now has the ICAC, the Independent Commission Against Corruption, which has chopped a lot of heads off and is looking seriously at a lot of these issues and has over the last couple of decades. So they had to put in an enormous corruption watchdog with a lot of teeth to combat the sort of thing that you see as a part of the background of this movie, Helga's Web. Now, I've said that the crime part is really interesting, and Jack Thompson and Shane Porteous make a good pair in doing the police procedural part of this film. The other part is the part I've got a problem with, and that is Scobie's personal life, which gets involved in the film in a really weird way. There's a really tonal shift there, because basically he's a root rat. He sleeps with a whole bunch of different women. He lives in an apartment block, which is basically a singles retreat, with topless ladies all over the swimming pool outside the units, and basically it's a playboy paradise in a sense. And he sleeps with three or four women during the course of the film, none of which is at all related to the plot line of the essential core of the film, which is that murder mystery. Now, Jack Thompson himself was living a very interesting life at the time, and what did for about 15 years. He lived in a menage a trois relationship with a pair of sisters, and this was known in Australia. It wasn't particularly a secret. And one of them appears in this film as the first woman that Scobie Malone sleeps with. Now, this woman's name, I don't know her last name, but her first name was Bunky. And she and Jack Thompson have a very hot and steamy sexual scene in this film, which is kind of interesting. It's a real one of his two real-life partners, in essence, in this film, sleeping with him. Now, why did this occur? Why was this part of the film, where it could have been a straight police procedural, Jack Thompson was fully capable of playing the role, and yet they've got this kind of dissonant emphasis on tits and ass in one part of the movie? Now, part of it is that kind of osploitation thing. Films with a lot of nudity in it did very well at the box office at the time. There were a number of them, things like Stalk and Alvin Purple and all those sorts of films. The light sex comedies were making a lot of money at the time, and I think that the producers thought they might make some money from it. The screenwriter for the film was also a very interesting character, a guy called Casey Robinson, who had an enormously long career in Hollywood before he actually retired to Australia. And this is the last screenplay he did. He was a screenwriter for a whole bunch of very good classic Hollywood films, which makes for a kind of weird coda to his career. I mean, he wrote the screenplay for Now Voyager and Captain Blood and The Snows of Kilimanjaro and Dark Victory. He did some rewrites on Casablanca and a whole bunch of other things. If you look through his IMDb page, there's a whole bunch of stuff in there, which surprised me. King's Row, he did the screenplay for King's Row, that movie where Ronald Reagan loses his legs, for instance. The Macomba Affair, Follow the Sun. Follow the Sun I like as a film too. That's one of the few golfing films, apart from Caddyshack, that I like. But, so Casey Robinson retired to Australia, but did this as his last screenplay. And he was very enthusiastic about Jack Thompson becoming an international film star. It didn't actually pan out. Later on, he became a well-respected character actor in a lot of things. But his career as a kind of A-list Hollywood movie star really didn't pan out, in a sense. But nonetheless, that dissonance, while I appreciate tits and ass as much as any guy does, I don't really think it fits in this film very well. At the time, I remember seeing it, and I was quite enthusiastic about the tits and ass. But re-watching the film with its flashbacks to Helga's life before she was murdered, and the interesting structure of the film, really worked for me. And I got into the storyline. I kind of knew who the murderer was, not too far in. They don't particularly hide it as the investigation goes on. If you pay careful attention, you can figure out who the murderer is. But I kind of like seeing the scenes of Sydney in the 1970s, when I lived there. I like the fact that everybody, it doesn't matter who you are, lives within sight of the harbour, which makes things kind of weird, because not everybody in Sydney lives within sight of the harbour. I only ever lived in with a tiny shard of a harbour view once in my life, when I was living in Roselle in an apartment block. But, the film's kind of worth seeing for a couple of reasons, one of which is some of the character roles, and The direction is not particularly adept. The director didn't really do much else apart from a few TV things. His name was Terry Olson, and he was mostly a documentary director, so the scenes of the outdoor scenes and the scenes of the landscapes are quite nice, but the structure of the film and particularly the editing is a little bit weird, because there's a weird piece of cross-cutting between Jack Thompson and his girlfriend in bed, and his girlfriend having an orgasm, and the police arriving at the opera house to investigate the finding of a body at the opera house. So that cross-cutting doesn't really work in any narrative way. But I think it was people trying to be a bit clever while not fully understanding the reasons why they're doing something. So, you know, like you'd have a second or two of a woman orgasming, and then they cut to a police car coming down towards the opera house, and then cut back, and then cut back back to the police car and the police thing. And it doesn't really work well for the story. Now, this movie you can get on DVD as well. Umbrella Entertainment have it for about $10. The reason I wanted to do it for the podcast, and there's a couple of reasons why. First one is I like Jack Thompson, an actor. I think Jack Thompson is one of those magnificent bastards of Australian cinema, particularly in his early career. Even things like Breaker Morant, the Bruce Beresford movie, he's really fine in that. He's fine in Sunday Too Far Away. He's really good in Peterson. I liked him as far back as a 1970 TV series he did with Peter Sumner called Spy Force, which still occasionally turns up on early morning television in Australia, where he plays basically a spy for the army during World War II, and they kind of travel around the Pacific war front doing various bits and pieces. It wasn't a TV series with a large budget, but it did have some good production values in spite of that. I've also got a hometown fondness for the Opera House as a location for movies. I grew up, all of my childhood, the Opera House was being built. They started building and then pulled down the old tram depot on Bennelong Point when I was 2 years old, and it wasn't until I was almost an adult that they completed building the Opera House. I remember I was at the opening on the other side of the harbour, underneath the harbour bridge, partying on, listening to bands. I was about 16 at the time, and people were handing me beers and things like that, and there was a really nice vibe to it all, and there was a big sense of celebration about the Opera House finally being opened. So I've kind of, a lot of it's nostalgia for me, a nostalgia for my time in Sydney and my life there and my knowledge of the 20th century history of Sydney. But this film, I think it is a lost opportunity in a sense. The dissonance between the two parts of the film as it's structured really work against it. I don't know that people realised it at the time, but it definitely does. But in spite of that, it is interesting to see all of these actors that Sydney was a sleazy and crime-ridden place at the time. In the 1970s, around the time this film was being made, I spent a lot of my time, so 1975, I would have been 18, I spent a lot of my time hanging around King's Cross. And I did go to strip clubs and things like that because I was 18 and they'd let me in. And kind of fleeing a bad home environment, I did spend a lot of my time up at the Cross. I've been working since I was 15, so I was earning a living at the time. And so I'd go up there and buy books and watch movies because there were a few cinemas up there and hang around there until really early hours of the morning, sometimes all night. So I kind of, in a sense, my history and the kind of criminal underworld that is shown in this movie do parallel, and I've got it's something I'm very familiar with, and seeing things that I'm familiar with from my teenage years in movies isn't something that Australians really have as much experience of as people perhaps who live in England or the United States. We don't see that part of our history reflected very much in cinema, but this film does do that. And maybe I'm overplaying the hand a little bit here and giving the movie more credit than it deserves, but it's worth checking out. Particularly if you're interested in exploitation and in seeing one of the most beautiful harbours in the world. So that's about it for Scobie Malone. As I said, Umbrella Entertainment, if you type in Umbrella Entertainment in the search engine, you can get an Australian DVD copy of it for $10. Delivery charges, of course, are more, and you'll need to make sure that you've got an unzoned DVD player. But having said that, it's a fine piece of exploitation, and it goes to show the strengths and the weaknesses of that genre. So my throat, as you can hear, is starting to go a little bit, so I'm going to take a break. I'm going to play the theme song to Scobie Malone, sung by Kerry Bedell, an Australian jazz singer. And when we get back, we're going to flash forward 10 years and take a look at the adaptation of Peter Corus's novel, The Empty Beach, starring Brian Brown, Anna Maria Monticelli, and Nick Tate. Okay, let's move on to the 1980s and the Brian Brown movie, The Empty Beach, based on one of the Cliff Hardy novels by Peter Corus, one of Australia's finest crime writers, in my humble opinion. The Empty Beach is based on a novel that appeared 2 years before. The novel was called The Empty Beach as well, which is one of those rare things. It's actually a movie based on a novel which has the same name as a novel. The cast is pretty good. Brian Brown as Cliff Hardy. Anna Maria Monticelli as Anne Winter, an investigative journalist. Belinda Giblin playing Marion Singer, who's hired Hardy to look for her missing husband. Ray Barrett as a crime boss called McLean. John Wood, another fine Australian actor like Ray Barrett, as Parker, the policeman who Hardy meets in his investigation. We've got Nick Tate as Hennebry, Bruce Hennebry, another investigative journalist, and a bunch of other people. The movie was directed by Chris Thompson, a guy who did mostly television, and it's directed competently. It's not directed fabulously, but the DP, the director of photography of the film, is one of the greats of the Australian film industry, and that is John Seale. Now, John Seale, if you have a look through his IMDb, has been director of photography on a ton of really good movies. He did Witness, The Mosquito Coast, Rain Man, Gorilla in the Mist, Lorenzo Azzurro, Dead Poets Society, The American President, The English Patient, The Talented Mr. Ripley, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, but you can't really have a winner all the time. Basically, he's one of the greatest directors of photography that this country has produced, and this film looks good because of that too. It's really eye-poppingly good, and it shows the Sydney landscapes, particularly along the eastern beaches, really well. It's a shame that this movie hasn't had a DVD release as well. The only way you can find it is to find a VHS rip, which is a shame. I know that CG has it, if people know what CG is. And it's not a bad transfer from a VHS, but I think the movie really does deserve to get the full DVD thing. If Scobie Malone got a DVD release, then The Empty Beach should well have done, though. Well, as with a lot of these films, finding the ownership and getting the rights to do it is a problem. Brian Brown is very good as Cliff Hardy as well. Cliff Hardy's appeared in over 20 novels now by Corus. And he's kind of an iconic crime protagonist in Australian literature. He lives in a terrace house in Glebe. He drives a battered blue Holden Falcon, which is accurate in the movie from the books. And he's basically an independent kind of guy. He's one of those lone wolf private eye kind of guys, but in very much an Australian context. And with good working class, left-leaning Australian belief systems, Cliff Hardy has in this movie and in the novels as well. I first found out about the novels, oddly enough, when I was working in a bookshop many, many moons ago. I was working in Bray's bookshop in Balmain, and lots of people from the Australian film industry turned up there. Bruce Spence turned up there, the guy who played in Stalk and was in the Mad Max movies. David Williamson turned up there. I sold books to both of them. And I didn't last very long because I wasn't very good. But one of the things I did do is I had Peter Corus's first Cliff Hardy novel recommended to me, and that novel was The Dying Trade. And then I've just swallowed them since, and every time I find one, I'll pick it up. I've got a stack of them in the spare room. I've actually got to move them into the man cave because Sal wants all of my crime novels out of the spare room. But they're good, solid reading material. The characters are crisp. The plotting is meticulous, and it's got a great tone to it. So if you can find any of Peter Corus's stuff out there, I'd highly recommend his crime novels. He's also now doing, he's kind of semi-retired now, but he does a blogging column for a nice little effort called the Newtown Review of Books. Now, I'm going to post a link to the Newtown Review of Books, and you can have a look at Peter Corus's columns there. He does talk a little bit about Cliff Hardy, but he also talks about a lot of other things, including what's happening with his life. Blogs regularly there. The most recent one is this month, so there is that. And it's a good little website for checking out what's happening in Australian literature as well. But getting back to the movie, Brian Brown's the perfect choice for Cliff Hardy. There was talk a couple of years ago of doing another movie based on the Cliff Hardy novels with the much older Cliff Hardy. And they were talking about getting Paul Hogan to play the character. That all fell through, but this is really the only movie adaptation of any one of Corus's novels, which is a horrible shame. There was a TV series that he wrote the scripts for called Poker Face, and that they starred Bruno Lawrence before he died. Obviously before he died. But apart from that, there haven't been any kind of cinematic adaptations of Corus's work, which is a shame because they're rock solid. There was going to be a TV series at one stage, but the ABC had the rights to do two different properties, and they were going to make a Cliff Hardy TV series, which would have been fantastic. But they had the rights to Corus's books, and they also had the rights to Kerry Greenwood's Friday Fisher novels. And they went with Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries instead, and of course, Essie Davis has done very well in the last three seasons of making Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries. But it would have been nice to see the Cliff Hardy ones as well. But anyway, Brian Brown's great. He's laconic. He's fun. I'll just play a little bit of the audio from him with Belinda Giblin playing Marion Singer. This is one of those ones where he meets the client for the first time. They're meeting on a pub terrace overlooking Bondi Beach.
Mr. Hardy?
That's right.
You're very punctual.
Never like to be late, Mrs. Singer. I might miss out on something good.
I was having a gin and tonic.
I'll join you. Thanks. Great looking day.
What do you think of Bondi?
Bondi? I like it. I'm proud of it. I don't.
How long since you gave up?
Oh, I don't know. Roughly 2 months, 16 days, 9 hours.
How do I begin? I mean, to confide in a private eye.
Oh, I don't know. Who recommended me?
The phone book.
Oh.
It's my husband, John. 2 years ago, he went out on his yacht and he never came back. The yacht was washed up on the beach and there was a suicide note in the cabin. It said that John had cancer and he couldn't face it. He'd taken 20 Mogadon and half a bottle of whiskey, and he intended to go overboard. He was never found. Did you read the newspaper reports?
Yeah. He was in real estate, something like that.
Real estate, taxis, pinball machines, you name it.
So what's your problem, Mrs. Singer?
John may not be dead. Here, I've been sent this.
I saw John in Roscoe Street, Mrs. Singer. He looks crook.
There was an investigation at the time, of course. I just want it settled. I want a serious inquiry. There's a check in there and a photograph of John. What else will you need?
That's a fair bit of money. Need a list of his business contacts, friends, acquaintances, places he went.
I'll look it up for you. I'll get them over to you this afternoon.
So you can see some of the self-depreciating humour that Cliff Hardy has in that scene. Again, like Scobie Malone, this is a part of the world that I know pretty well. My mother lives a couple of kilometres down the beach from where they filmed this, at Bondi. There's Bondi, Tamarama, Coogee. My mum lives in South Coogee, so it's just along the eastern suburbs and in the eastern beaches from Bondi Beach there. Bondi Beach is a problematic place now. It's full of tourists from all around the world. It's lost a lot of its charm and a lot of its flavour, and you can't get parking there, and it's a bit of a bloody nightmare, really, these days. I did live for a brief time in Bondi Junction, where I was house-sitting for a very nice gay couple at the time for about 3 months, and, yeah, it was a nice part of the world. Good sense of community there at the time, but a lot of that gets lost when places become touristy, and you can't get even a flat there for less than $1 million these days. There are some very, very nice set pieces in this movie as well. There's one scene where Anna Maria Monticelli's character, Anne Winter, and Hardy, as a side issue to this investigation into John Singer's disappearance, investigate what turns out to be a nursing home for old people from nightmares. Looks a lot like one of the sets from a Saw movie, preceding, of course, the Saw movies by decades. But it's really nicely put together, and that's where the cinematography by John Seal really comes into its own. Hardy and her are in the basement of a building with a flashlight, opening up this nightmarish scenario and this nightmarish place where people are basically imprisoned for their pension checks. So that, even though it's not particularly relevant to anything else in the movie apart from bonding between Anna Winter and Cliff Hardy, it really is an incredibly effective scene. There are a few action scenes as well. There's one where Cliff Hardy's about to be killed by the henchman, in a sense, of a politician, which works really well. And the movie ends with a midnight shootout outside the Bondi Pavilion, which is an historic old building on the Bondi waterfront, which kind of works really well. It's not a prolonged action sequence. It goes pretty fast, as these things tend to in real life, and it does work well. I mean, there's a great rapport between the actors. A lot of the actors said that they were very intimidated by Brian Brown, not because he did anything particularly, but because he was so very good at it. And some of them have said that their acting wasn't quite up to par because of that. They've just felt overwhelmed by how good Brian Brown was in the role. Having said that, there's a nice scene, there are a few nice scenes between him and John Wood playing the copper who's gets involved when things get sticky for Cliff Hardy.
All right. You walked down the alleyway, you heard a shot, you ran.
And I got hit.
You must have seen something.
Yeah, I saw a star.
Very convenient.
What's that supposed to mean?
What do you think it's supposed to mean?
You tell me.
Why did you go after Leon, Hardy? What is the connection?
He saw Hannah be killed, didn't he?
Did he?
What's going on here? Leon was a witness. Why weren't you guys out looking for him? What are you trying to do? Sweep enemy under the carpet?
Watch it, sport.
Bit of pressure from
your face,
mate.
Would have an accident with the wall.
Not me, mate. I respect public property.
The question is, Hardy, what did Leon have to do with your case?
Hasn't anyone ever taken any of this away?
I don't think so. Look, do you want me to throw you in the slammer?
Can't do that.
Can't I?
No, I asked for 2 days. You said okay. I'll still...
Yeah,
I'll
well,
still
your deadline has just been slashed, sport. You come back here at 10 o'clock tonight when you will name names. Goodbye. Oh, as regards your license, Hardy, it can be taken away just like that. No one liked Tenebry. I hated his guts. But he was a very interesting man to a lot of people.
So that's John Wood, fine character actor. People know him from a lot of TV stuff that he did, but Good actor. Nick Tate's in it as well, playing Henry, who was mentioned in a previous scene. Nick Tate, people know from all sorts of things. He was one of the spaceship pilots in Space 1999, and then became a voiceover guy in America doing voiceover work, introducing movies, you know, in a world, those kind of things. He did a lot of that kind of stuff. There's also one of Australia's most famous playwrights of the last 30 years who has a small role as a cafe owner called Aldo. That is Stephen J. Spears, who, amongst other things, wrote a very fine play called The Elocution of Benjamin Franklin, which, oddly enough, John Wood, who plays the copper in this film, did a very famous stage version of a number of years ago. So there you go. It's all a bit incestuous in the Australian arts industry, really. But, I mean, I like this film. There are a couple of weak spots, one of which is the soundtrack. The music score is by Martin Armiger and Red Simons, and it's a little bit generic and a little bit synthy and very kind of 80s for that, and doesn't really distinguish itself. Red Simons is now the breakfast radio guy at the place where I do my radio gig, ABC Local Radio in Melbourne, and he's doing quite well with that. He's in his 60s now, but he is blitzing the ratings, and every time I go up and do my radio gig, I have to walk past the studio where he does his morning gigs. Now, the movie wasn't successful at all. There are a couple of reasons. Anna Maria Monticelli was supposed to be playing Anne Winter, who was supposed to be a kind of feisty, whip-it-thin, very active woman. It's a very well-written role in the... a very well-written character in the book. But she turned up on set, and she was pregnant, having a child to none other than the action film director John McTiernan. And so to hide the pregnancy, she had to wear a lot of loose clothing and couldn't really be as athletic and kind of feisty as the script and the character determined. She's not bad in the role, but she's not particularly good in it either. Maybe she had morning sickness at the time, I don't know. But a stronger actor would have been a lot better in that role. But the character bits are good. The direction's kind of pedestrian, but the cinematography is really good. And the script isn't bad as well. They did get a guy in to do the script. Peter Corris had a couple of goes at it as well. Did a few drafts of the script, which the first time he did it, they said it was too soft. The second time he did it, they said it was too hard. And they got in a guy from England called Keith Dewhurst, who'd done a number of things, most of which were TV series like Zed Cars and Softly, Softly in England and Juliet Bravo. And he came in and had a pass over the script, and his script was ultimately the one that ended up on the screen. I think that may have been a bit of an error. Doing Chorus of script, even if it was a bit harder, a bit soft or whatever, would have been much better, because the Cliff Hardy books are very, very Australian in based, and they're kind of steeped in Australian culture in a sense, and getting a scriptwriter in from somewhere else who maybe doesn't understand the nuance of Australian culture can kind of water things down a little bit, and I think that's a little bit of what happened here. There's Brian Brown, as I said, is very good, and a lot of the other actors are very good, but it's one of those missed opportunities. There was a joke at the time that the movie should have been called Empty Cinema instead of The Empty Beach, but I like it. I've liked it since I first saw it in the cinemas, and I do like seeing genres like detective stories told from an Australian viewpoint. Doesn't happen very often at all. There have been a few detective TV series in the past, but not lately. I think that this kind of story is something which in this computer age is a lot harder to do, where information is accessible really fast and ubiquitously. It means that the private eye is an anachronistic construct in a lot of ways, which I find a bit sad and not really the way I'd want things. And there is that kind of knight without armour. There's almost a gunslinger thing to a private eye. He goes out and investigates things and rights wrongs and doesn't always win, but wins just enough to keep himself going. And that kind of thing. I do like that aspect of things. And it's a very iconic character, the private eye. And I think that this movie is not a dishonourable version of that. I would have liked to have seen a lot more of these movies with Brian Brown. He went over to Hollywood and did movies like FX and Cocktail, and is now back working on stage. He's doing a lot of stage work here. He and his wife, Rachel Ward, are still supporting the Australian arts industry, Australian film industry to a big extent, and have become kind of elder statesmen kind of people in that industry. As far as the future of Australian cinema is concerned, who knows? Government funding for the arts has been slashed because we have a Conservative government and they don't really understand the arts, and they don't understand the fact that sometimes, even though things don't make a lot of money, the training and the experience that the people who make it get from doing it pays off in the long term. There's a long tail to arts funding, which people who are purely working off a spreadsheet don't really see. But there are some good things happening in spite of this current climate. The Jack Irish stories, excuse me, I'll take out the cough lolly. The Jack Irish stories that are being done, starring Guy Pearce, are worth checking out. If you see a DVD of them or a torrent or whatever, they're well worth taking a look at. They're good, honest Australian crime fiction done on a television budget, but done very well. And Guy Pearce is very good as Jack Irish. And then, of course, then there's Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries with Essie Davis, which are out on DVD around the place and are worth checking out. They're period pieces set in the 1920s, but they're very accessible, very cool. And they do, in spite of themselves, give little bits of Australian history that a lot of people aren't aware of. It's being in the 1920s, it's set after the Great War and all of the turmoil there, and that kind of does influence the way the stories are told, and indeed some of the stories. So they're worth checking out as well. But there's not too much else to say about Scobie Malone and The Empty Beach, except for the fact that I think they're honest efforts. The first one, much more misguided than the second one. I think the second one didn't get the love that it deserved at the time. And I think it was a time, too, when people were turning away for some reason from Australian cinema. The movies weren't making money. TV and video had just come in, so a lot of people were watching stuff on videotape, which had a weird kind of impact on the film industry at the time. People would rather spend the money releasing older stuff on DVD, on VHS at the time, than putting the money into producing new stuff. So anyway, I'm going to leave it there because my throat is giving out and I'm starting to get a bit dizzy, which is never a good thing. Just going to wrap this up too. I don't have any feedback again this time, which is, well, let's be honest, it's your fault, not mine. But anyway, enjoy your movie viewing over the next little bit. I'll be back with the Star Wars edition of the Martian Drive-In podcast in a week. And in 2 weeks, I'll be having a chat with our friend Armin in Germany about a couple of films he's recommended for the podcast. And I look forward to doing that. So anyway, take care of yourselves. I'll be back very soon. And I'll just play the credits now, followed by the theme music by Mark Hunter and Wendy Matthews of The Empty Beach. Okay, it's time for the credits, and I'd like to thank all of the supporters of the Patreon campaign. So we've got Alyssa, our location scout, Tansy, our Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jan, the dialect coach, Gary, the property master, Morris, the music director, Armin is the key grip, and Tom is the focus puller, otherwise known as first assistant director. Thank you all for your support of Paleo Cinema and the Martian Drive-In podcast.
You got it?
Yep. Bondi, you want to come?
No, can't speak New Zealand. Singing the Bondi sun, watching the seagulls, watching the sea, hoping no one comes along. I've got all the empty beach I need. Sitting in the Bondi sun, reading about the recovery, 40 cents and all of M1.
I'm